This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of Inside the Atheist Mind, Unmasking the Religion of Those Who Say There Is No God, by Anthony DeStefano, published by Thomas Nelson and read by the author. A note to atheists. If you're a militant atheist, the kind who loves the writings of Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and that whole crop of arrogant unbelievers who are in such vogue today, please note that this book is not written for you. My purpose is not to convince you to believe in God or to prove God's existence in any way. There are hundreds of books on the market that do that already. No, this book is not for you. It's about you. It's about all those wonderfully deceptive, malicious, ignorant, cowardly, and hateful things that you say and do on a regular basis. This book is also not meant for agnostics who are sincerely searching for the truth, or for people who are angry at God because of some terrible suffering they've endured. Again, there are many good resources that attempt to help people who are honestly struggling with their faith. No, the focus of this book is on those obnoxious and aggressive new atheists who not only reject God, but who also wish to evangelize the whole world with their gospel of nothingness. In the opinion of this writer, too many books written in response to these pseudo-intellectual blowhards have been altogether too nice. The authors have all tried to be kind and reasonable and amiable in an effort to demonstrate that believers don't have to sink into the mud in order to defend their faith. That tact is charitable and extremely admirable, but unfortunately, it just doesn't work with bullies. And that's exactly what modern-day atheists are. Bullies. So if you happen to be one of these militant atheists and you intend to read further, please don't expect the sort of kind and gentle approach you've experienced when dealing with believers in the past. There won't be any coddling, respect for your views, friendly debate, dialogue, or turning of the other cheek. Not in this book. I'm afraid there's only one way to deal with bullies, even in this politically correct world, and that is to crush them. Chapter 1. The Arrogance of the Atheists. I'm sure you've seen them before. Arrogant, spoiled children. Kids who have no respect for their parents, their teachers, their elders, their peers. Kids who, for some reason, think they know everything, when in reality, they know nothing. They're condescending, obnoxious, prone to shouting, mean-spirited and selfish. They're the kids who are always bragging that they have better clothes, better sneakers, better toys, better video games, better houses, better everything than their friends. They never seem to learn humility. They're always clamoring to be first, always looking for attention, always screaming to be recognized as the best. And if, by chance, they aren't given the credit they think they deserve, then woe to the guilty culprit whose fault it is, because that person will be treated to a noisy temper tantrum. The type of arrogant children I'm talking about never take correction in a constructive way. They never take any kind of challenge to their superiority. Their reactions are always anger and petulance. Even worse, these children never seem to know when to keep their opinions to themselves. As someone once said of them, 2/3 of what they think on a topic is borrowed from their parents or older siblings, and the remaining 1/3 is based on whether they have an immediate desire for something. Now, kids like this usually have no basis for believing the things they do. Their attitude stems from some form of immaturity or insecurity. But if their arrogance, by chance, is founded in real circumstances, for example, if the child comes from a wealthy family or is gifted in some way, then their smugness is often of the very worst kind. Left unattended or uncorrected, these are the kids who become the notorious bullies and haters of the world. But whether a child's arrogance is a consequence of wealth, upbringing, immaturity, insecurity, or simply natural disposition, the end result is always the same: rudeness and bad behavior. The end result is always a child who mistakenly thinks that everyone is beneath him, who deludes himself into believing that he is somehow smarter and better than everyone else, when in fact, he is much worse. Now, most of you who are listening to these words have encountered children like this at one time or another. If you have, please fix that image in your minds for just a few minutes. It will be very valuable in understanding not only the subject of this chapter, but also the theme of this entire book. Because this image of the typical arrogant, condescending, bullying child that I've just described is, in actuality, the exact picture of the typical modern-day atheist. That's right. Just as we've all seen spoiled, misbehaved children in action, we've also witnessed the spectacle of the new atheists spreading their particular brand of toxic arrogance throughout society. You know who they are. They're the ones who are offended by the slightest bit of religious imagery in the public. The ones who are mortified even if a whisper of Merry Christmas escapes the lips of some well-meaning but naive department store clerk during the holiday season. The ones who object vehemently to the phrase, "In God we trust," on money or the walls of government buildings. These are the self-righteous twits who cause a storm of protest whenever something overtly religious is spoken of in anything but hushed tones or behind closed doors. These folks are loud, nasty, unapologetic, and in your face. And unfortunately, they're not going away. In the following chapters, I'm not going to focus on proving God's existence or showing how much sense it makes to be a believer. As noted earlier, plenty of books on popular theology do that already. Rather, my main purpose here will be to expose once and for all the blatant hypocrisy, dishonesty, and intellectual bankruptcy of the atheists themselves. For when you really look at what the new atheists are saying, you don't find a carefully constructed, logical argument against the theistic position. In fact, you don't find any argument at all. What you find is a lot of hot air, a lot of bluster, a lot of disdainful, unfounded, and empty dogmatism. Above all, what you find is arrogance. Arrogance has been the calling card of atheists for a long time. It didn't start with Richard Dawkins or Bill Mayer. Friedrich Nietzsche, the great patron saint of atheism, and coincidentally, the favorite philosopher of Adolf Hitler, a fact atheists conveniently neglect to mention, proclaimed famously in the 19th century that God was dead and in his grave. That preposterous pronouncement set the tone for atheistic arrogance over the next 100 years. The militant atheists of the 21st century have raised this kind of pretentious egotism to an art form. Sam Harris superciliously writes, quote, "It is time that we admitted that faith is nothing more than the license religious people give one another to keep believing when reasons fail," end quote. And that, quote, "atheism is not a philosophy. It is not even a view of the world. It is simply an admission of the obvious," end quote. Richard Dawkins haughtily states, quote, "Faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is a belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence," end quote. Bill Mayer rants, quote, "Faith means making a virtue out of not thinking, and those who preach faith and enable and elevate it are our intellectual slaveholders, keeping mankind in a bondage to fantasy and nonsense that has spawned and justified so much lunacy," end quote. Christopher Hitchens condescendingly pontificates that, quote, "Religion comes from the period of human prehistory where nobody had the smallest idea what was going on. It comes from the bawling and fearful infancy of our species, and is a babyish attempt to meet our inescapable demand for knowledge, as well as for comfort, reassurance, and other infantile needs, end quote. These are not arguments. They're snide schoolyard taunts, and they demonstrate perfectly the deeply ingrained sense of superiority that modern-day atheists seem to have. By ridiculing believers for failing to accept the obvious and copping out and evading evidence and being infantile, they show themselves to possess the very same traits that are so characteristic of the arrogant children I just described. The position of the typical atheist today can be summed up in the following way. Believing in God is not just wrong or misguided. It's tantamount to insanity. It's the same as believing in Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. Since there is absolutely no empirical or scientific evidence for God, there can be no rational basis to believe in him. Since God can't be seen, felt, or heard with the senses, and since there isn't any geological or fossil record of him, and since he can't be proven mathematically, he simply can't exist. Period. The reason why so many people throughout history have believed in God, they smugly assert, is because these poor ancient folk were ignorant of scientific facts. If they had known what we know, they never would have believed in something so absurd as God. And as for the people today, who still believe despite the marvels of scientific achievement, they've obviously been brainwashed by their religious upbringing, or have some kind of psychological need to believe in a supernatural being and an afterlife. They surmise this dependence comes from three primary sources: a fear of death, an unwillingness to accept the permanent loss of loved ones, and an inability to cope with life itself. In other words, modern atheists think that those who believe in God fall into one of two general categories. We are either imbeciles or cowards. This is not an exaggeration. This is truly what the new atheists believe. Read God is Not Great by Hitchens, The God Delusion by Dawkins, or The End of Faith by Harris. The titles of these books betray the attitudes of the authors. Not one of these works presents a carefully reasoned argument against belief in God. They are all diatribes against the very notion of belief. The bottom line is that atheists today do not acknowledge any connection between faith and reason. According to them, to be a believer means ipso facto that one must have below average intelligence. It means that one has no ability to think rationally and lacks the necessary mental and emotional strength to face the problems of life unaided by recourse to prayer and other such superstitious practices. Mostly it means that one must be devoid of any real understanding of science. The most laughable thing about this position isn't that it's unfair or untrue, which of course it is, but that it's so extraordinarily ironic. In fact, it's one of the most hilarious parodies of rational argument ever put forth by anyone, anywhere, at any time. Even the most cursory glance at history shows that the whole discipline of rational thinking on this planet, as well as almost all our scientific knowledge, comes not from atheists, but from the minds of men and women who believe deeply in God. Putting aside philosophy, logic, and mathematics for a moment, let's just take the field of science as an example and conduct an abbreviated survey of its principal historical figures. First, who was the father of science and the father of scientific thought itself? The great Aristotle, of course. Now, Aristotle, being an ancient Greek philosopher, didn't know anything about the founders of the world's major religions. But the man who organized and classified human thinking into categories such as biology, physics, zoology, and epistemology, and the man who is still recognized today as perhaps the greatest thinker who ever lived, did believe in divine intelligence. In fact, Aristotle rejected the notion of a strictly material universe and instead posited the existence of a first uncaused cause. This first cause of the universe is another way of saying God, and Aristotle believed in him. What about Francis Bacon, the father of empiricism? Empiricism is the theory that all knowledge is derived from sense experience, a position so dear to the hearts of atheists today. Bacon is also the person credited with establishing the inductive method of experimental science. In other words, he was the man who created the scientific method itself. Did he believe in God? Yes, he did. And he was a devout Christian, too. In fact, his last written words were in the form of a prayer. Quote, "Be merciful unto me, O Lord, for my Savior's sake, and receive me into thy bosom," end quote. Pick another famous scientist from history at random. Say, Leonardo da Vinci. He was an inventor, a mathematician, a botanist, an astronomer, and an engineer. Da Vinci was the father of medical anatomy, paleontology, geology, ichnology, aircraft design, and a host of other scientific disciplines. He was the prototypical universal or Renaissance man. Did he believe in God? You bet he did, and he created some of the most sublime religious paintings of all time. What about the father of physics? Arguably the most prominent scientist of the scientific revolution of the 17th century and the man who discovered the principle of gravity. This was Isaac Newton, and he too believed in God. Indeed, the greatest geniuses of physics, including Daniel Bernoulli, the man whose work underlies the operation of the modern automobile and the airplane wing, Wilhelm Röntgen, the discoverer of X-rays and the winner of the first Nobel Prize in physics, and Max Planck and Max Born, the founders of quantum theory and quantum mechanics, all believed in God. The supreme figures in astronomy, Copernicus, Galileo, and Kepler, all believed in God. The supreme figures in the field of botany, Brunfels, Turner, and Boerhaave, all believed in God. The father of modern chemistry and the man who developed the first periodic table of elements and postulated the law of conservation of mass, Antoine Lavoisier, believed in God. The founder of electromagnetism, Volta, who invented the battery and whom the volt is named after, as well as Ampère, who the amp is named after, believed in God. Michael Faraday, who helped establish electromagnetic theory and electrolysis in the field of chemistry, believed in God too. Louis Pasteur, the famous French chemist and one of the main founders of bacteriology, renowned for his discoveries of the principles of vaccination, microbial fermentation, and pasteurization, and whose scientific work provided direct support for the germ theory of disease, was also an ardent believer in God. In medicine, Albrecht von Haller, the father of modern physiology, and William Harvey, the father of the modern study of anatomy, believed in God. So did William Keane, the pioneer of brain surgery, and Joseph Murray, the Nobel Prize-winning pioneer of transplant surgery. Indeed, the whole modern age of science was pioneered by believers. German scientist Wernher von Braun pioneered rocket technology. Ernest Walton was the first person in history to artificially split the atom. Wireless technology, including cell phones, radios, and our whole global telecommunication system, exists thanks to Guglielmo Marconi. Charles Babbage, the mathematician and analytical philosopher, is known today as the first computer scientist, and the man who originated the idea of the programmable computer. All of these men believed in God. And while we're on the subject of the pioneers of science, who do you think coined the term scientist in the first place? The answer is William Whewell, an Anglican priest and theologian, who also came up with the words physicist, cathode, anode, and many other commonly used scientific terms. Essentially, the very language used by scientists today comes from the brain of a believer. None of these giants in the field of science was an atheist. All believed in a supreme being who created and designed the universe. The list goes on and on and on. It includes scores of Nobel Prize laureates and presidents of scientific academies and institutions. It is a list that spans the globe and all of time itself. It is a truly staggering list. And what do atheists make of that list? Nothing. They ignore and dismiss it, as they ignore and dismiss so many other challenges to their thinking. Or they do their feeble best to explain it away. They'll say, for instance, that these God-fearing scientists didn't know about the theory of evolution, or genetics, or the Big Bang theory. They conclude, therefore, that the list really isn't as impressive as it may seem. But even that objection betrays an ignorance of the history of science that borders on the insane. When Charles Darwin wrote The Origin of Species in 1859, the work that first proposed the theory of evolution, he was definitely a believer in God. It's true that as he grew older, the spectacle of human suffering weighed heavily on his heart and caused him to doubt the existence of a personal creator who cared about his creatures. But Darwin always struggled with his lack of faith. He was at times a Christian and at times an agnostic, but he never thought that his scientific theory was incompatible with the idea of God. Rather, he thought that while God did not have a direct hand in creating the different species of the world, he did indeed create the natural laws that govern the cosmos, including the laws of evolutionary development. Therefore, Charles Darwin, the father of the theory of evolution, was not an atheist. And what of the science of genetics, the means through which evolution supposedly takes place? According to proponents of evolutionary theory, it is only through genetic mutation and the process of natural selection that life on this planet is able to undergo gradual development. Who, then, was the father of this field of study? The answer is Gregor Mendel, an Augustinian friar and abbot of a Catholic monastery. This monk, botanist, and professor of philosophy was the man whose famous experiments on peas led to the formulation of the rules of heredity and to the proposal of the existence of invisible genes, which provide a basis for the science of modern genetics. Well then, what about the Big Bang Theory, the leading explanation of how our universe began? Surely an atheist must have had a hand in that. Nope, wrong again. In fact, the man who proposed both the theory of the expansion of the universe as well as the Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe, effectively changing the whole course of modern cosmology, was Father Georges Lemaître, a Belgian astronomer and Roman Catholic priest. Yes, you heard that right. A priest came up with the Big Bang Theory. If you don't believe it, look it up. This cleric, who taught physics at the Catholic University of Leuven, delivered a famous lecture on his theories in 1933 that was attended by Albert Einstein in California. When Einstein heard Father Lemaître delineate his theory, he said, quote, "This is the most beautiful and satisfactory explanation of creation to which I have ever listened," end quote. Now, how could this be? How could the father of genetics be a monk and the father of the Big Bang Theory be a priest? Didn't these men know what all modern atheists seem to take for granted? That the very theories they espoused contradict the idea of God and nullify the possibility of his existence? Didn't they know that their belief in God was therefore absurd? Were they really that blind? Or is there, perhaps, another explanation? Could it be that these great men of science were not blind at all, but rather that modern atheists fail to understand the most simple principle of rational thought, namely, that explaining the scientific process of how the universe came to be does not in any way explain why it came to be. It does not explain the fundamental mystery of existence itself. This mystery can never be explained by science. Even if the theory of evolution were true, for example, and life on this planet developed gradually over a period of millions of years, it would not in any way prove that God does not exist. Why? Because, as someone once said, A slow miracle is just as much a miracle as a fast miracle. That's why Joel Primack, the American astrophysicist who co-developed the cold dark matter theory, which seeks to explain the formation and structure of the universe, has written, quote, "In the last few years, astronomy has come together so that we're now able to tell a coherent story of how the universe began. This story does not contradict God, but instead enlarges the idea of God," end quote. You see, what atheists can't seem to understand, or probably just don't want to accept, is that no matter how wondrous the study of science can be, it is extraordinarily limited. Science will never be able to answer the question, where did everything come from? Or why is there something instead of nothing? Or how can matter be eternal? Or why is the universe so organized? Or why did life arise from lifelessness? The answers to these questions lie beyond the realm of science. That's why the greatest scientists in history have never been stone-cold atheists. Even Albert Einstein, who did not subscribe to the tenets of any religion, recoiled when people mistakenly thought that he might not believe in God. Quote, "I am not an atheist," he stated emphatically, end quote. Quote, "In the view of such harmony in the cosmos, which I, with my limited human mind, am able to recognize, there are yet people who say there is no God. But what really makes me angry is that they quote me for support of such views," end quote. Einstein knew there was something more to the universe than he or anyone else could understand. In fact, he once said, quote, "The most beautiful emotion we can experience is the mystical. It is the source of all true art and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead," end quote. Atheists want us to dismiss the notion of the mystical. They want us to believe that the world is made up of physical objects and nothing else. They want us to believe that everything in life, our thoughts, our dreams, our passions, our loves, our hates, our hopes, our virtues, our sins, our griefs, our arts, our deepest desires for eternal life, that all of this is purely the result of biochemical reactions and the movement of subatomic particles. That's not rational thinking. That's superstition. Yet atheists continue to repeat their moronic mantra. It's absurd to believe in God. It's obvious that he doesn't exist. It's ridiculous to have faith in something you can't see. All religious belief contradicts scientific and empirical evidence. Human beings only invented the concept of God because they want to go to heaven. Amazing. Bear in mind that we've only just scratched the surface. We've only talked about scientists in this chapter. We haven't even mentioned the greatest historians, painters, sculptors, architects, musicians, novelists, poets, generals, monarchs, explorers, and doctors. We just don't have the time to list the supreme figures in all these fields. But if we did, rest assured that the overwhelming majority believed in God. Once again, the point here is not to prove God's existence by providing an all-star list of believers, nor is it to prove that any particular religion is correct, nor is it even to disprove the atheist position. The point is simply to demonstrate the mind-boggling arrogance of modern-day atheists. These pompous prigs ridicule believers for being infantile and unwilling to face facts. Yet they dismiss not only the greatest figures of science, but also the greatest minds in history, as well as the vast majority of people from all places and at all time periods. Which brings us back to the example of the arrogant, bullying children we began with. You can take children like that by the hand and patiently explain your thinking to them. You can show them 100 examples of why their behavior is rude and condescending. You can try everything under the sun to be polite and argue reasonably with them, but none of it ever does any good. Common sense and appeals to logic just aren't effective against deeply ingrained false pride. What, then, is the remedy? Well, some old-fashioned parents, completely out of vogue with modern methods of child-rearing, might suggest that in the worst cases of childish arrogance, a light spanking is in order. While this tactic might offend some of today's politically correct psychologists or sociologists, the fact is that sometimes this is the only thing that works. And so, for the remainder of this book, we're going to do just that. We're going to give the new atheists the equivalent of an intellectual spanking. In fact, we're going to give them such a spanking that they'll probably cry foul and say we're being unfair and intolerant and hateful. They'll probably even throw a temper tantrum. They always do. But that's okay. We're going to do it anyway. Not just because they deserve it, but because they need it. That's the only way they're ever going to learn any humility. That's the only way they're ever going to grow up. Chapter 2. The Ignorance of the Atheists. After arrogance, the predominant characteristic of the modern-day atheist is ignorance, tremendous ignorance. In fact, atheists display more ignorance than perhaps any single group in the world. In truth, it should be counted as their main distinguishing trait, and indeed, it probably would if we were judging strictly according to the volume of information they seem oblivious to. But the qualitative nature of their arrogance, that is, the level of condescension they show towards believers, is so impressive that we're compelled to give ignorance second place, if only to be fair to them. Now, ignorance is defined as a lack of knowledge or information. It can take many forms, but the worst kind, the kind that can really be problematic, is that particular brand that carries with it some modicum of knowledge. Everyone has heard Alexander Pope's observation, "A little learning is a dangerous thing." That's exactly what I mean. A small amount of information gleaned from books or TV shows or college courses can mislead people into thinking that they're more expert than they really are. It can give them the illusion that they really have knowledge when they don't. And that illusion, just like mirages caused by hot air rising in the desert, can lead people to act in destructive ways. In the early 20th century, for instance, little was known about the chemical element radium. The dangers of radioactivity had not yet been discovered, so a few ignorant doctors began using radioactive materials as a therapy for various illnesses. In fact, all kinds of products, including medicines, toothpastes, face creams, even inhalers, were manufactured using these dangerous substances. The result was a slew of new cancer-related deaths, all because some experts were in possession of a limited amount of knowledge. This same dynamic can be seen in practically every area of life. How many young people have taken a few lessons in the martial arts and mistakenly concluded that they had expert fighting skills? What happens to these ignorant amateurs when they get into an altercation with someone who really has advanced skills in unarmed combat, or someone who has a weapon? Or how about the world of business? How many people read a few books on entrepreneurship and come away thinking that they have the business savvy of J.P. Morgan, only to waste their savings on some harebrained scheme that any seasoned business person would have dismissed? And what about all those cases of people who do a little medical research online and start to fancy themselves physicians, wildly misdiagnosing themselves and others based on a few random symptoms, consequently causing a tremendous amount of anxiety for everyone involved? Or what about teachers who think that they have great intellects just because they've managed to acquire a few letters after their names? How much havoc have these pedantic tyrants wreaked in the classroom? How much damage have they done to young, impressionable minds? In all these instances and more, a small amount of knowledge leads to false pride, and then to faulty decision-making and disastrous judgments. That's why this particular brand of ignorance is so insidious, because it has the potential to be both stupid and dangerous. And here again, we arrive at the perfect picture of the modern-day atheist. whose ignorance of history is mixed with just the right amount of knowledge to be colossally misguided. Atheists today are under the impression that belief in God has always been detrimental to civilization. In fact, they've asserted that, over the long course of history, those who have practiced religion, especially those who call themselves Christians, have been guilty of the greatest evils imaginable. They've repeated ad nauseam the tired refrain that religion has been responsible for more wars, murders, and bloodshed than any other single factor, and is therefore to be regarded as a blight on mankind. Take, for example, some of the typical statements that have come out of the entertainment industry. Celebrities, most of whom are not exactly known for their deep thinking, don't ever seem to hesitate to express their negative opinions of religion. Elton John, for instance, has said, quote, "From my point of view, I would ban religion completely. The reality is that organized religion doesn't seem to work. It turns people into hateful lemmings, and it's not really compassionate," end quote. Actress Gwyneth Paltrow agrees, quote, "Religion is the cause of all the problems in the world. It's what separates people. One religion just represents fragments. It causes war," end quote. Comedian Bill Murray declares, quote, "Religion is the worst enemy of mankind. No single war in the history of humanity has killed as many people as religion has," end quote. And talk show host Bill Maher says, quote, "Religion must die for mankind to live. We are a nation that is unenlightened because of religion," end quote. This whole way of thinking is best summed up by Larry Flint, publisher of Hustler magazine and clearly a paragon of virtue, who said, quote, "Religion has caused more harm than any other idea since the beginning of time. There's nothing good I can say about it," end quote. Nothing good can be said about it. Religion is the worst enemy of mankind. It should be banned. Pretty powerful words. One would think they would be backed up by solid evidence. But alas, they're not. They never are. These nit-witted celebrities can't ever seem to get beyond cliches. I would venture to guess that not one of the individuals previously quoted has the slightest clue how our civilization came to be, or what historical forces contributed to the progression of modern society. Most of them simply parrot ideas they've heard or read, which happen to agree with their own feelings or their, shall we say, lax brand of morality. When they do attempt to use arguments to articulate their beliefs, they usually refer back to the same old anti-Christian books, such as Hitchens' God Is Not Great or Dawkins' The God Delusion. These books, which can be more accurately described as hit pieces on God, are neither original nor insightful, yet they masquerade as serious works of scholarship and are quoted as such by atheists all over the world. In The God Delusion, Dawkins states that if the Bible is true, then God is, quote, "a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully," end quote. Armed with such a juvenile understanding of Scripture and such hateful adjectives to describe God, it's no wonder modern atheists view religion through a coal black lens. It's no wonder their whole understanding of history is warped. Briefly, atheists believe that religion, especially Christianity, has been harmful to mankind for five primary reasons. First, they claim that faith in God robs people of their ability to engage in critical thinking, as well as their ability to learn new facts that might contradict their superstitious dogma. Second, they think that religion is the enemy of art, that it is responsible for the widespread censorship of books, music, paintings, and speech. Third, they argue that religion teaches people to be helpless and rely on an imaginary supreme being rather than on themselves, thereby destroying human freedom and enslaving mankind. Fourth, They say that belief in an afterlife stops people from making the most of this life. Fifth, they think that religion seeks power and encourages bloodshed, and is therefore responsible for countless deaths. That's what atheists believe. But are any of these positions really true? Let's start with the notion that religion is detrimental to critical thinking. As we discussed in the last chapter, many geniuses of science not only believed in God, but were also ardent Christians. We saw how atheists choose to ignore this fact because it goes against their belief that science and faith are natural enemies. But if, for a moment, atheists actually tried to be fair-minded and asked themselves the simple question of why Christianity has produced so many great scientists, they might have realized the equally simple answer. Because the Christian system of belief is founded on the idea that there is a rational God who is the source of rational truth. Christianity teaches that there is a purpose and design to the universe. Now, if something has a design, it follows that it must exhibit some kind of reasonable and rational behavior. It must, by definition, give rise to certain predictable laws and principles. This system of laws and principles is the whole basis for scientific investigation. That's why the practice of science as an organized and sustained enterprise of the human race arose in a civilization that was overwhelmingly Christian. One of Christianity's core beliefs is that things make sense, and furthermore, that it's our duty as human beings to find out how and why they make sense. That is the basis for all rational thinking. Indeed, it's impossible to study history without seeing the extraordinary role Christianity has played, not only in the development of rational thinking, but also in the spreading of such thinking. That is, the creation of an educational system. Though education was important in the pagan world, it didn't become institutionalized until Christianity began its march across the globe. The early Greeks and Romans had no public schools of higher learning. It was Christians who established those. When the Huns, Goths, Vandals, Visigoths, and other barbarian tribes overran what was left of the Roman Empire, it was the Christians who took the smashed European continent and imposed learning, order, and stability upon it. In the so-called Dark Ages, it was the Christians again who painstakingly preserved, copied, and studied manuscripts from antiquity in order to pass them on to future generations. Christianity, therefore, was responsible for the Renaissance, or rebirth, of Greek and Roman culture. Now, if the Christian religion had really been so opposed to critical thinking, why in the world would it have acted so decisively to protect and preserve the writings of Plato, Aristotle, and other pagan philosophers? Why wouldn't Christians have burned them in a big bonfire, as atheists claim they are so fond of doing to books that contradict the faith? But there's more. It was the monastery system of the church that maintained the intellectual culture of the West for hundreds of years and gave birth to the first universities and libraries. These great institutions spread throughout Europe and provided a systematic, as well as integrated, form of public education for the masses. For the first time in history, individuals from all social and ethnic groups were included, without bias toward ethnicity or class. This contribution was revolutionary. Nor was it just the Catholic Church that was responsible for the development of education. The Protestant reformers, who wanted everyone to be able to read the Bible, introduced to the world the concept of compulsory education for boys and girls. This, again, was a radically new idea. With all this focus on learning, is it any surprise that, later on, all but one of the first 123 colleges in colonial America were founded as Christian institutions, including Harvard, Princeton, and Yale? And what of the criticism that religion is the enemy of art? Jack Uberman, in his book, The Quotable Atheist, says, quote, "Religious authority has always sought to control and censor art and literature," end quote. Likewise, Rob Boston writes in Church and State magazine, quote, "The truth is, Religiously based censorship of the arts by the government has a long history in Europe and the United States, end quote. Now, this is an area where atheists really have to work hard to maintain a state of ignorance. After all, how can anyone ignore the monumental influence that religious faith has exercised on all art forms, visual, musical, and literary? How can anyone say that religion has only been harmful to the world, when the world's greatest paintings, sculptures, architectural structures, musical compositions, and literary masterpieces were inspired by or directly commissioned and paid for by religious institutions? Is it possible atheists haven't heard of Michelangelo's Pietà, or David, or the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, or Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper, or any of the religious works of Rembrandt, Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Shakespeare, Dante, Dostoevsky, Milton, Dickens, and thousands of others? Is it possible they've seen the outside or inside of a Gothic cathedral or a Baroque basilica and not recognize the artistic heights to which a person is capable of soaring when inspired by religion? The point here isn't that the creators of these magnificent works were Christians. It's that the creations themselves, infused with the spirit of religious fervor, could never have been conceived without the Christian faith. Just as scientific inquiry was founded on the idea that God and his creation are rational, so too religious art was founded on the idea that God and his creation are beautiful, and that humankind, being made in the image and likeness of God, has the power and the responsibility to make beautiful things too. This is the philosophy that lies behind so much of the world's greatest artistic expression. And yet, atheists continue to claim that religion has always been the enemy of art. Amazing. They also contend that religion destroys freedom. But again, an unbiased look at history shows the exact opposite to be true. The biblical concept that all people are created in the image and likeness of God is the foundation of universal human rights, including freedom. Before Christianity, human life on this planet was considered cheap. Infanticide was not only common, but applauded. Newborn children were routinely abandoned on the hillside, left to starve or freeze to death, or they were killed outright through drowning, especially if they were baby girls. Adults didn't fare much better. Everyone has heard about Roman arenas like the Colosseum, in which whole families were bludgeoned to death, mauled by wild animals, or burned alive just for sport. The greatest and most respected ancient writers and philosophers didn't object in the slightest to these barbaric practices. It was Christians who finally banned them. Why? Because the religious belief that all men are created equal is not a self-evident truth, as Thomas Jefferson famously wrote. To pre-Christian cultures, equality was a totally foreign concept. When the people of antiquity looked around at the world, they saw inequality everywhere, in physical appearance, mental capacity, moral conduct, economic and material possessions, and political power. The idea that all human beings were equal would have seemed preposterous to them. It was the Christian religion, building on Jewish tradition before it, that introduced the bedrock principle that all human beings are equal, maybe not in physical traits or material possessions, but in dignity, in honor, in value, and in spirit. Most importantly, Christianity taught that human beings are equal because God created them and loves them equally and to an infinite degree. Therefore, each human life has equal and infinite value. This is a Christian insight, not a pagan, secular, or atheist idea. When people today proclaim that human beings have a universal right to express their opinions freely, to go wherever they choose, to buy and sell property, to live the way they want to live, they are expressing an idea that has a distinctively Christian origin. As Dinesh D'Souza says in What's So Great About Christianity, quote, Christianity emphasizes the fact that we are moral agents. God has freely created us in his own image, and he has given us the power to take part in his sublime act of creation by being architects of our own lives. John Stuart Mill's influential doctrine of liberty, which so many of us take for granted, is a direct inheritance from Christianity. It is no use responding that Mill was a product of the Enlightenment understanding of human freedom and equality. That notion was itself a product of Christianity. Where else do you think the Enlightenment thinkers got it? End quote. The point that atheists refuse to grasp is that Christianity espoused a revolutionary philosophy of equality that set into motion an intellectual process that gradually changed everything. It was Christianity which rejected polygamy and adultery and exalted monogamous love, love geared toward the raising of children. This is the basis for the traditional family. And no matter how much secularists decry that institution today, there is still no other force more stabilizing and beneficial to civilization. It was Christianity that dramatically elevated the status of women at a time when practically every other culture in the world oppressed them. Indeed, the ancient world treated women like animals. Read the Greek and Roman historians, such as Thucydides, Polybius, and Livy, to verify the truth of this. Women were the property of men, just barely higher than slaves. They had no rights at all. That's why they were so frequently exposed to the elements as infants. Christianity changed that. Women had leadership roles in the early church. They were supported financially when their husbands died. They were given an education. Instead of being abused, they were sheltered and protected. The whole medieval concept of chivalry arose because Christian civilization considered women to be of a higher dignity than men. The undisputable fact is that the women's rights movement of the last 200 years has its roots not in pagan society, but in the principles of Christianity. The same can be said about slavery. Atheists are always claiming that because Christians owned slaves at various times in history, the whole Christian religion is hypocritical. But that's nonsense. Slavery was practiced for centuries all over the world before Christianity came on the scene. No one ever criticized or opposed slavery in any systematic way until Christianity. From its very beginning, Christians discouraged the enslavement of fellow Christians, and many early Christians purchased slaves for the sole purpose of setting them free. Because human dignity is at the heart of Christian doctrine, it was only a question of time before Christians began to realize that the very idea of owning another human being was contrary to their faith. By the Middle Ages, the institution of slavery, which provided the whole foundation for Greek, Roman, and Egyptian civilizations, was largely replaced by serfdom, a system which at least guaranteed basic human rights to all workers, such as the right to marry and to own property. Later, it was Christians who started the first anti-slavery movement in history. It wasn't Democrats who did that. It wasn't Republicans. It wasn't politicians or unions or any other kind of socially conscious group. And it certainly wasn't atheists. It was the church. Slavery came to an end in Europe mainly because of the work of Christian activists such as William Wilberforce, the famous British evangelical philanthropist. And the successful anti-slavery movement in England, made up overwhelmingly of religious groups, took the lead in the international campaign to end slavery as well. By the early 1800s, two-thirds of the members of the American Abolition Society were Christian ministers. We see the same positive influence in every area of social reform. Take economic freedom. The ancient world, built on the backs of slaves, had no real concept of the value of labor. Yet Christianity, with its emphasis on human equality and dignity, revolutionized the workplace. The concept of private property, property rights, workers' rights, and unionization all flow from the Judeo-Christian understanding of work and its proper relationship to social justice. Take the world of politics. We've seen how the idea that all men are created equal has its origins in the Bible. Well, the whole idea of limited government comes from Judeo-Christian tradition too. The notion that there are certain God-given unalienable moral absolutes, such as the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that take precedent over any edict issued by a king, derives from Christianity. Is it any wonder that so many of the founding fathers of the United States and at least 50 of the 55 signers of the U.S. Constitution were committed Christians? And what of the argument that Christianity is so concerned with getting people to heaven that it neglects to care for them here and now? This is perhaps the most preposterous of all the atheist claims. Before Christianity, there was virtually no institutional interest in helping the poor, the sick, the mentally ill, the disabled, the elderly, or the dying. But because of Christian teaching on the dignity of the human person, this societal callousness came to a screeching halt. In the year 369, St. Basil of Caesarea founded a 300-bed hospital, the first large-scale hospital for the sick and disabled in the world. Christian hospitals and hospices started springing up all over the European continent. These were civilization's first voluntary charitable institutions, and they were built and paid for by the church. To this day, Christian influence permeates the healthcare system. Just do an internet search for Christian charities and see how many names appear. They are legion. Missions to foreign countries. Organizations to fight world hunger. Inner-city soup kitchens, and ministries to assist those with every kind of infirmity. Think of the Red Cross and the Salvation Army. Think of Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity. Think of all the orders of nuns established to care for the diseased and dying. Think of all the Christian orphanages that have helped so many abandoned and destitute children over the centuries. Think of the thousands of religiously affiliated hospitals that are still in operation across the globe. There's simply no end to the number of charities founded in the name of Christ. Why do they all exist? The only plausible explanation is that, contrary to what so many feeble-minded atheists believe, the Christian gospel is not just about getting people into heaven. It's about improving conditions in this life, too. And isn't that logical? If human beings are really made in the image and likeness of God, and if they truly have infinite value, then of course it's an obligation for us to be caring and compassionate, to help people everywhere, especially those who are least fortunate. And yet, atheists insist that Christians have their heads in the clouds and are happy to sit back and twiddle their thumbs as they await the second coming. That's not an easy thing to do. It takes a lot of effort to keep your eyes clamped shut in the face of so many facts. How can anyone with even the most rudimentary knowledge of history be so ignorant of all these social, intellectual, scientific, cultural, political, educational, institutional, and artistic gifts that Christianity has bestowed on civilization? Christ said that a tree is known by its fruit. If the Christian religion is so terrible, how could its fruit be so bountiful and beneficial? Bear in mind, we're not saying here that Christianity is perfect or that it's been free of hypocrisy. It hasn't, not by a long shot. But in evaluating the cost-benefit ratio of anything, especially something as large as a religion, you must separate individual examples of evil from the overall pattern of good. You must look at the big picture. And here again, we return to that particular form of ignorance rooted in a little knowledge. Atheists love to go through history searching for rotten fruit. When they discover some, they zealously rush to judgment without any real understanding of history itself. They find examples of Christians who've read the Bible simple-mindedly, and they conclude that religion is the enemy of science. They find examples of Christians who ban certain books as blasphemous, and they conclude that religion is the enemy of education. They find examples of Christians who denounce various paintings as obscene, and they conclude that religion is the enemy of art. They find examples of Christians who own slaves, and they conclude that religion is the enemy of freedom. They find examples of Christians who wrote about happiness in heaven, and they conclude that religion is the enemy of happiness on earth. In a word, they look for dark specks on the vast canvas of history, and when they discover them, conclude that the canvas itself is completely black. when in reality it is astonishingly white. It makes you wonder if perhaps we're not just dealing with ignorance. Perhaps there's something else at work, something deeper. After all, we still haven't addressed the fifth criticism of the atheists. We haven't talked about all the blood that's been shed in the name of religion. We haven't talked about the infamous Crusades or the dreaded Inquisition. Perhaps it's time we looked into those notorious events. In fact, while we're at